It's time to think bigger.
Elias Pettersson scores!
And think bolder.
Matthew Tkachuk, what a goal!
This is Rintoul and Sermon.
Another chance, great save by Markstrom.
Here is shot, rebound, great save by Dimko.
On the Sportsnet Radio Network.
What's going on? How's your Wednesday? Hope you're off to a great start. We're going to make it better. That's what we do. It's Scott Rintoul. It's Karen Sermon. It has already been a big news morning, Karen.
Oh, it's been a great day, especially if you are a Canadian tennis fan. Scott, 3 hours and 26 minutes of my life this morning. Yes, I watched every single second of it. It was amazing. I have been smiling ear to ear for the last about 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's a big news Monday. We got significant news from the Canadian Football League this morning. We have a Canadian Olympic hero who has called it a career. And as you just alluded to, one of the country's rising stars athletically. He's broken new ground, not for Canadian tennis, but for himself. Denis Shapovalov has made his first Grand Slam semifinal after a narrow five-set victory at Wimbledon this morning. He got off to a great start. Then he found himself down 2-1. He came back with a dominant fourth set, and it was touch and go the whole way in the fifth set. But this is where you've seen the progression of this young player, because this job does not get done a year ago. This job does not get done 2 years ago. This is where the evolution of Denis Shapovalov is at.
Absolutely, Scott. And it's not in the physical game. It's in the mental game. It's his brain. It's his belief. It's the not getting down on significant points at 2-2. Karen Khachanov was down a love 40. Yes, Felix, I'm watching him right now. Denis had three break points. He let it get away from him. The Denis in the past would have probably dropped his shoulders and the match would have been over. At that point, Khachanov probably would have rolled. No, it didn't happen. He stuck with it. He served beautifully. He broke at 4-4. Well, how many minutes was that game, Scott? It seemed like 25 minutes. Went on and on and on. Seven break chances it took him to finally break, and then he serves it out. The evolution of him is just, it's almost complete.
Still a little ways to go, I hope, because I hope this isn't the ceiling. I don't think it is the ceiling, and boy, does he have a tester coming up. We'll get to that in a second. It's going to be the world number one. It's going to be the most dominant player in men's tennis right now, maybe ever, Novak Djokovic in the semifinal. There were 2 points specifically where Denis Shapovalov could have seen this go off the rails. And I do think in previous years it would have. Certainly 2 years ago. But we saw him get to the quarterfinal at the U.S. Open last year, and that represented progress. I told you a couple days ago I wanted to see him get past the quarterfinal into the semi. That would represent a significant step for his career. That's how highly I think of Denis Shapovalov. And maybe it's not fair to put Ogier Aliassime, who is playing right now, as you just talked about, on the same plane. We lump them together because they're very good friends, best friends, similar age. Ogier Aliassime is younger, and he is breaking new ground for himself right now. Denis Shapovalov, at the end of the third set, you saw him demonstrably upset. We've seen that before. In previous years, that would have carried over. But he flushed it. And he came out, and he rolled in the fourth set. And then, when the match ultimately turned, ninth game, fifth set, tied 4-4. He's got an opportunity to break. You talked about all of the different break points. There's one of them specifically. Like, he has a kill shot to win it, and he misses. He hits it long. And that was actually something in common with these two players in that particular deuce opportunity. They both kept hitting it long. At that point, you wonder if Shapo in previous years would have gone, I just missed my opportunity. There it was. I had an open smash attempt here where I should have put this away and I hit it long. How did I let this get away? But he kept on battling. And it's that resolve that is the difference right now with his game. It may not be enough against Novak Djokovic, but it's enough to put him through into the Final Four at the All England Club. And we're getting set for a big one on Friday.
This is the step that we've all been waiting for. It's the step that he needs to take mentally. It's the physical tools have always been there, but when he gets down on himself, Scott, you said the demonstrative shoulder shrug. He yells at his boxes and his coaches when he makes mistakes. It's just so evident when he's not happy on the court. The forehand goes awry. The first serve percentage goes from his game. And when you see that go, you know that Shapo's in for a tough match. He held strong today. I saw it in the quarterfinals for against Bautista Agut when the game kind of went awry in the third set, even though he was up 2-0, but he's playing a veteran guy. I saw him get his game back. Today, I've been just as impressed with you, Scott. It just been that mental step forward that he needed to take. It never wavered. Get this, the fifth set, he never let Berrettini have more than 1 point on his serve. He was still dominant when he had that serve. 86% of first serves won. That is impressive. I'm looking forward to the semifinals. Tough matchup against Novak Djokovic. He's 0-6 against him in his career. But hey, this is one step. The next one is what can you do against world number one?
If anybody out there was watching this prior to the show today, you saw what I saw. You saw a crowd that loves Denis Shapovalov the way that many of the tennis-gazing Canadian community does. He is an easy player to gravitate to. He saluted the crowd. They saluted him back. You can see there's this reciprocation between the two sides. And the crowd kind of went, oh, yeah, it's Novak Djokovic. Boy, that's
right?
Tough
like,
for
oh,
you.
Boy.
Here's what I loved about his answer, though. He was asked about Novak Djokovic, and he said, look, yeah, it's a tough matchup. He's the number one player in the world. But when I come out here on Friday or whatever it's going to be, scoreboard's going to read 0-0 when we start mm-hmm. that match. Anything is possible. He's got belief. He's not calling his shot in saying that, but you can see the confidence right now. You can hear the confidence from this young man.
As he should. I mean, he's playing phenomenal tennis, and he's gotten through some tough matches. And I like exactly what you just said and exactly what he said. Like, it's 0-0. Anyone's game to start. And we'll see the ebbs and flows, and we'll see if he can get Djokovic down and on the run. Like, there's a lot of things that have to go his way to win that match. But it's the, I'm not out of it before I play the match. We have seen this before with Roger Federer throughout his career. If you were a young player or any player going into a match against Roger Federer, especially in quarterfinals, semifinals, finals of Wimbledon, you basically talked yourself out of the match before because you're like, I have to beat Roger Federer on grass. That's not going to happen. He's the greatest player of all time, especially on this surface. So if Dennis can just go in, Chapo can go in with the, it's 0-0, does not matter. You know what? That's the mentality that he has to have. As long as he doesn't beat himself in the lead-up to that match, I think there's be some... I mean, hey, I'm not saying he's going to win, but I'm just saying if he can go mentally in, not beating himself prior to taking on Novak Djokovic, you never know what could happen.
So Shapo's into the semis. His good friend Felix Auger-Aliassime trying to join him there right now. It's very early. They are on serve, though Aliassime is facing a break point here in his second service game of the opening set of this match. We'll keep you updated on that as the morning goes on. It's been a good vibe Wednesday already for Canada, and we will get to the CFL story, which is positive for a lot of CFL fans this morning. We will get to that aforementioned Olympic hero, and maybe Felix keeps it a really good Canadian Wednesday. Maybe the Montreal Canadiens keep it a really feel-good Wednesday for this country. And some people aren't cheering for the Montreal Canadiens. Some people are just cheering for the story. I don't know if you want to label it what would be the Montreal miracle or the comeback the Canadien. We're a long way from getting there. We're going to have to see a win tonight. But this is what's suddenly possible. And yeah, it's going to be tough. And the Tampa Bay Lightning are heavily favored to win this game tonight. But maybe the good Canadian vibes permeate the Stanley Cup final as well and give us a game six on Friday.
I'm hoping for that. In tough, back home in Tampa, it's been 2 years, two playoffs, since Tampa has won or lost back-to-back games in the Stanley Cup playoffs. So the betting favorites would have Tampa Bay. The betting favorites would say, well, Tampa played pretty well to win that game four. Why will they not win game five on home ice? The good news is, Scott, it looks like Hurricane Elsa is not going to prevent this game from going on. NHL says, yes, it's going, even though the hurricane did continue through this morning. I saw some videos. That's some intense high wind that they have there and some rain that was coming in. But good news is we're going to get a hockey game tonight. I jumped on the Habs bandwagon, you know, going forward. I basically said I'd like to see them win. I want to see it come back home. But speaking of come back home, but I do think that this isn't a series, obviously, until Tampa wins tonight. Like, you have to give Tampa some doubt, and you have to give them... I can't say that, okay, Montreal can easily win this one, and they're going to come back to Montreal. No, it's going to be still tough, but let's just make it to Game 6 and make Tampa have to think about it a little bit.
As opposed to what England is hoping for later today and certainly on the weekend, the Cup actually has been home here in Canada. It was pointed out by Casper Schmeichel to an English football reporter earlier this week. And we'll talk about that. Craig Forrest is going to join us in the third hour of the program. We've got a lot to get to. We will head down to Tampa Bay. Dave Randorf is there. He's the play-by-play man for the Tampa Bay Lightning. We'll get a Lightning perspective. We'll get a Montreal perspective later in the program from Stu Cowan as well. I said it after game four, and I'll say it again. We don't have a series yet. We don't. I want to believe. I want to see a game six. I would love to see a game seven. Montreal wins tonight, we've got a series.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to imagine. I want to imagine that something that everyone writes off, it can't happen, it can't happen. I want to imagine that it's possible. You heard what Denis Shapovalov said today. Anything is possible. And so it got me thinking about some of the great comebacks in championship history. We've seen a lot of them this century, Karen. I'm going to limit it to this century.
Okay.
Let's not go back beyond 2000. But when we start talking about the great comebacks this century, and we're also going to limit the field in this way as well, I want to talk about championship games. I'm not talking about what happens in the first round, what happens in the second round. I'm not talking about something that's a quarterfinal. No, let's talk about championship comebacks. You know, in tennis, we talked about it off the top. Novak Djokovic just pulled one off. Now, it's not going to go on my list. I don't consider it there with the other ones against Tsitsipas, especially because we expected Djokovic to win that. But it is a great comeback. And if you look at what Federer and Nadal and his contemporaries have done, they've actually never done that. They've never come from two sets down in a Grand Slam final to win. So it is an impressive comeback. But if we start talking about some of the great ones of this century, what comes to mind for you?
I mean, the obvious and the first one is... It was 28-3.
Yeah, it was 28-3.
It was 28-3. There are shirts. It was 28-3. When you have any comeback in any sporting event, specifically football, though, that compares it to it was 28-3. That's the one that sticks in my mind. That's the 2017 Super Bowl, of course. The Patriots down in the third quarter, 28-3, end up coming back in overtime. When it's one of the, or when it's the largest comeback in Super Bowl history, I mean, that has to be one of the greatest comebacks. But to me, it's just it always sticks in my mind. It was 28-3.
And it wasn't just 28-3. It was 28-3 with just over, I guess, 23 minutes to go. There were 8.5 minutes left in the third quarter. Maybe it was 8:13 on the clock. And it was 28-3. When the Patriots began to mount that comeback. And all of these involve the other team stumbling to a certain degree. To which extent may determine your answer to this, because we're asking you today, 960, 960, 650, 650, what is the greatest comeback in championship history this century? It's got to be a championship game. It's got to be a series. Certainly that qualifies, and that will be top of mind, and there are a lot of people that will argue for the Patriots here.
Were you at that Super Bowl?
I was not at that Super Bowl. Okay. I was watching it, as was somebody who threw out that challenge to Jeannie Bouchard on Twitter and ended up getting himself a date out of that as well.
I remember that game because I was watching with a group of my girlfriends who, not exactly into football, but it's Super Bowl, we're going to have a party. You know, I didn't want to go to the bar, so I'm like, I'm going to go watch with my girlfriends. It was 21-3 at the half, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, I just want to watch Lady Gaga at halftime. See what kind of performance she has. I'll go home, catch the fourth quarter, see what happens. But you're thinking to yourself, 21-3, the Falcons are in dominant fashion. The Patriots really can't do anything. Like, they're not going to blow this lead, right? Lady Gaga puts her incredible performance on at halftime, talking about the greatest performances of all time at the halftime show. And then it goes 28-3. I'm like, okay. Yeah, like I should really go home so I can just see the end of the game and see the Lombardi trophy handed out. And then I decide, no, I'm just going to stay and have a couple more pints. And then what happens? Tom Brady gets on fire and the Falcons fall apart.
Yeah, they do. And we can go through the anatomy of that game as we progress in the program. But that one certainly has to be on the list. And that was one in a line of comebacks. because that's the 2017 date, but that's really the 2016 season. That's considered the 2016 Super Bowl, even though that game occurs in early February of 2017. You roll it back to 2016. Well, just a few months earlier in baseball, you saw a team that hadn't won a World Series in over a century find itself on the brink, down 3-1, and yes, have a listen. The Chicago Cubs complete the miraculous comeback.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series! Bryant makes the play! It's over! And the Cubs have finally won it all! 8-7-10!
Now, I'm not sure how many people will actually vote for this or will say, yeah, that's the one I consider the greatest comeback, Karen, because of the opposition. Cleveland also had a lengthy drought, but it wasn't just that the Cubs were coming back from a 3-1 series deficit and came back in that Game 7 of that series. It's the fact that the Cubs were battling history, the burden, all of that.
108-year championship drought. I will say this, Scott, my boyfriend, he drank a bottle of champagne by himself after that win in extras. He's a massive Cubs fan. We went to Chicago, saw the Cubs play there. He was one of the people that would probably pick this one as the greatest championship of all time. Again, it's the drought that adds to it. Like, it's the 28-3, it's because 28-3, like the deficit in that score. And we look at the Cubs, well, they were down 3-1. But then at that point, you're playing with the mental history of a 108-year drought. And then you get it back to Game 7. And then you have the whole history, the incredible heroics within that game. The Rajah Davis home run. Then you've got the rain delay. Shouldn't have been a rain delay. And then you've got the 10th inning. Like, there's so many things that happened in that game that makes it pretty epic. But I think you always just have to point to the drought and the 108 years in that one.
So that one has to be on the list for your consideration, as does something that happened earlier in 2016. It is the greatest finals comeback in NBA history. It's the only time a team down 3-1 has come back to win the series in 7 games. It was LeBron James. It was the Cleveland Cavaliers. It was this iconic moment.
Picked off by Iguodala to Curry. Back to Iguodala to the rim.
Oh, great block.
James out of nowhere skies to the rim. He bats it away, and J.R. Smith recovers.
It's an incredible defensive play, and it's also one that gets more acclaim because in the final 4.5 minutes of that game, only one basket was made. Kyrie Irving is the only player to make a field goal in the final 4.5 minutes of Game 7 of the NBA Final. There were free throws made, but that was it as far as field goals go. LeBron James, the block, the coming back from 3-1 down, and it's against the Golden State Warriors, a team that was coming off back-to-back championships.
Going for those back-to-back titles, Scott, and they wanted the... It wasn't the Kevin Durant era quite yet, but that led to Kevin Durant going there. But you had Draymond Green in his prime. Andre Iguodala was such a presence on that team. Steph Curry was playing incredible. Klay Thompson. I mean, the list goes on. The players that are still there, but they were just playing at such an incredibly high level. And when you think that you are up 3-1 and you go home, right? Like, you go home and you think, we can win this on our home court. LeBron and Kyrie put up epic performances in Game 5, 41 points. But remember, that was the turning point in that series, that Game 5, because Draymond Green got kicked out because of the fourth flagrant foul. We all know what that flagrant foul was. Didn't play in Game 5. That was the turning point in that series. And yes, Cleveland comes back and wins. It was epic for LeBron, bringing the title back to Cleveland. It's going to be hard for me to vote which one is which, but that one was, again, just one of those more epic, think in your mouth, this is not going to happen. It's the Golden State Warriors. I know it's LeBron, but it's Golden State.
Well, and that was a historic season. You're right. They were looking for back-to-back championships at the time. They weren't coming off back-to-back championships, but that's the 73-win season. That is the greatest regular season in NBA history, and LeBron and company come back to get the job done against that team. Others that deserve consideration here as we look around sports, we can't play any audio because you know what the restrictions are regarding Olympics and footage and all of the audio and visuals and all of that. The 2014 Women's Team Canada that comes back against the USA down 2-0 in the final 4 minutes of that game. They score 2 goals to send it to overtime. They kill off a penalty in overtime. Marie-Philippe Poulin wins it for Canada in Sochi. I have that on my list. I think that definitely deserves consideration when you consider the odds of being down 2-0 against the powerhouse that is the United States in that tournament. Everything's been shut down to that point. They find a way to get that game to overtime. They find a way to win that. That has to be one of the great championship comeback moments.
I had to go back and rewatch a bit of the footage. And again, the footage is not actual footage, Scott. You have to watch someone's like recording of their television because, again, the Olympic IOC has some restrictions on that. What adds to that game as well was the fact that Canada was going for a fourth straight Olympic gold medal, right? Like, that was on the line. And the fact that the U.S. had been so dominant and not giving Canada anything, and they finally get it to overtime with that the goalie pulled, they score the game-tying goal, and you forget in overtime, it's 4-4 in Olympic international play, right? And a couple penalties called, it's four ends up being 4-3, and then, yes, Canada goes on to win it in overtime. Olympics adds a little bit more. And I understand that, you know, we talk about the World Series and 108-year drought. We talk about the NBA title. But, I mean, it's handed out every year, right? You talk about, what was the other one we talked about here? You talk about tennis, coming back from two sets to none down. But when it's something that's every 4 years, it's against your epic rival. It's the gold medal game. It just adds so much more to the event.
We've had a lot of people point out one thing in particular, and I'll tell you why it doesn't qualify here as the show goes on. But we did have Mike and Victoria point out this. We're going to talk footy a little later in the show. This has to be considered when you look at the teams involved and you look at the stakes. It was Liverpool coming back from 3-0 down in the Champions League final against AC Milan.
Oh, saved by Dina Chabalonzo! And Mission Impossible is accomplished!
Second chances if Shevchenko misses.
He saved it! The European Cup is returning to England and to Anfield. Liverpool are champions of Europe again!
We're going all the way back to 2005 for that, but what an incredible... Anybody who watched any part of that will never forget it.
It's called The Miracle of Istanbul. Anything that's titled The Miracle has to be up there in terms of biggest championships to come back. 3-0 from Milan in the first half. Within a 6-minute span of the second half, Liverpool scores 3 goals to tie it up. Win and penalty kicks. The miracle of Istanbul, Scott.
It's on our list. Which one sticks out for you? We can have that conversation as the show continues. Perhaps we'll ask our next guest as well. A lot of people are mentioning the Yankees being up 3-0, the Red Sox coming back. It's not a championship series. That's not a championship opportunity. And I know you got to get out of the AL, and I know the history of the Red Sox and the history of the Yankees. You might consider that the greatest playoff comeback. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about in the ultimate test, whether it's a game, whether it's a series, you got to be in the championship to qualify today.
Yeah, you do. A couple of texts quickly coming in, Scott. Pats versus Falcons, the franchise never recovered. And the best part of the Patriots' comeback against the Falcons is the owner. As the game goes on and their lead grows, he comes down just before the comeback starts and look on his face when the lead collapses. I remember that. Arthur Blank coming down thinking he's going to spend the second half on the sideline. His team's going to win the championship. And oh no.
His face appropriately named Blank. At one point during the course of what happened. It's been a big day for Canada already, for Canadian athletes, for Canadian teams. Maybe that continues with Montreal tonight. It has for our next guest. We'll explain why when Tim McAuliffe joins us on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
Okay, guys, we got to define the parameters here. And we tried to, but some people are taking liberties. It's Rintoul and Sermon. Tim McAuliffe is going to join us in a second. Well, it's the American League Championship Series, said Marcus and Gibson's, with the Red Sox and the Yankees. I know, but we're talking about the ultimate series. We're talking about the ultimate series here.
You got to win a championship out of it.
Exactly. So we'll make that clear. I know how big that comeback was. I know how many people loved it. I know what it led to for the Boston Red Sox. And we look at them entirely differently now because of that series and because they went on to win a championship that year and broke their lengthy drought, which never reached 100 years but was approaching 100 years at that point, unlike the Cubs, who did go over the century mark. So I know what it represents, but we're talking about greatest comeback in either a championship game or a championship series. And if you weren't clear before, you know what we're talking about now. Montreal's got a long way to go to get there, but if you're imagining them, what could be possible, that's the basis. Hey, could this be an historic comeback? Obviously got a win tonight, and that looks like long odds being in Amalie Arena for the Habs, down 3-1 in this series and everything that the Tampa Bay Lightning are. But it begins with a spark. They got one the other night. Who knows if that can, you know, turn into some sort of fire for the Montreal Canadiens. But you can keep texting us, 960-960, 650-650. What is the greatest comeback in a championship series or game? Someone else referenced the Seahawks against the Packers, NFC Championship. Again, that's a league semifinal. As much as it's a conference final, it's a league semifinal. They're great comebacks, but we're trying to limit the field a little bit here.
Minor Matt in Abbotsford says, does the Oracle Team USA comeback against Emirates Team New Zealand in the America Cup count? Oracle was down 8-1 at one point. Minor Matt in Abbotsford, I'm assuming 8-1 is a very large deficit when you're talking about, is this sailing at this point? I don't even know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But it's like, Minor Matt, I'm going to have to take your word for it on this one. I'm not exactly up on my America's Cup history.
Yeah, we didn't factor sailing into this one, but the field is open. If that's where you want to go, Minor Matt, you go there. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon. I mentioned there's some good news for the CFL today. At least a lot of CFL fans think so. The CXFL, or whatever hypothetical name that you might have created in your own brain for a professional league that might have been formed by the CFL and the XFL, well, it ain't happening. The statement coming out today, we talked a lot. Who knows how far down the road they got, Karen, but the CFL will not be merging with the XFL at this time. There are a lot of Canadian football fans breathing a sigh of relief.
Yeah, I'm not exactly surprised, because since this came out and we kind of all drew attention to it, it was there and then it kind of went away. And once the CFL announced that they are coming back this season, they put out their new schedule. Randy Ambrosi had his comments after that. He really downplayed it. He said, well, we'll see where it's going to go. Didn't really say too much on it. For me, I'm kind of a little happy that it is. It's like, I want to see the CFL stay Canadiana. If it was to merge or do something with the XFL, what would have changed about that? I understand that there's still some issues, a lot of issues, for the CFL to work through, but I'm kind of happy that this has gone to the wayside.
I was typing that out this morning, and I realized that CXFL, if you try to say it, it almost sounds like SexFL, and that would have been a hell of a marketing ploy, but I don't think they're going to go down that road. At least that's the statement that comes out today from the Canadian Football League. As I mentioned, it's been a big day for Canada. Canadian Screen Awards nominations coming out today as well. And our next guest is nominated as a finalist in the category of Best Host. Tim McAuliffe joins us today. How are you, sir?
Man, did they screw up, eh?
By putting anybody by putting anybody near you, like it should have just been you? Is that what you're suggesting?
God's honest truth, guys, I've been nominated twice, and I know most of the audience has no idea what the awards that we're talking about are, but regardless, I've been nominated twice for the Canadian Screen Awards, which is the Canadian version of, I guess, the Emmys. And both of them have occurred on shows that have been turned off the air. I was once nominated for The Score Tonight after it was canceled, and I am now nominated as Best Host for Tim and Sid, which no longer exists. God's honest truth.
So anybody working on Tim and Friends is hoping you are never nominated again so that this show can continue.
That is correct.
Listen, you're a big national team, Canadian athlete guy, so I know you were as disappointed as I was, as Karen was, as Canadian basketball fans were with what you saw this weekend. How much did you need what Chapo did this morning and what Felix perhaps could do if he can come back and beat Berrettini in this quarterfinal at Wimbledon? How much did you need that for your Canadiana today?
Yeah, it did help my Canadiana, without a doubt, to see Chapo move on, but These are two separate things, and like Scott, Karen, you know, you lose a little bit of the fan in you when you become when you work in the industry and you meet your heroes and you go through the day to day of it all. There's some fan that's beaten out of you. I still have the fan for Canadian basketball, and right now that fan is pissed. That fan does not know how to go out over it, and whatever Canadiana I get in the next couple of days, whether it's the CFL or the SexFL or whatever you want to call it. And this is, don't forget, Scotty, as you were saying that, I was remembering that this is a league that once went with the catchphrase, our balls are bigger. But
I
whatever,
the same
I'm not going to walk down.
Radically Canadian.
Walk down, I'm radically Canadian. Our balls are bigger. I'm not going to walk down that road. Those two things are separate. I am happy for Chapeau. One of the producers at Sportsnet, Chris Black, tweeted out a picture of Bianca Andreescu and Denis Shapovalov at a challenger tournament 4 years ago where they're warming up in a kid's playground. And I just, it was just such, like, to see how quickly the Canadians have come along from what was once promise and something that we've been promised in a bunch of different sports, including basketball, to where they are now. That's why I love sports, because you never know. And the golden generation of Canada basketball hasn't lived up to the billing as of yet, but it's amazing to see what the tennis players are doing.
I'm with you, and it doesn't erase what happened on the weekend, because I was bitterly disappointed, especially after that incredible last-minute comeback and Andrew Wiggins hitting crazy shots and sending things to overtime, and then the lead, and then the lead gets away. It's easy to just look at that game and say, how did they not get the job done? But this is a four-year, and in this case, five-year process of trying to get to the Olympics. What should the takeaway be for Canada basketball as it looks to make good the next time around?
I think for me what it is that the players who give their heart and soul have to look the players who aren't showing up in the eye and say, we need you. Everyone else has shown up, including former CIS U Sports stars who got them to this point and had to sit there and watch that happen. Like, there's this big family that has to now, because of the way you have to qualify for the World Cup and the Olympics, there is this extended family that needs to be a part of this. And that includes guys that are playing professionally in Europe who give their time in order to get Canada to these spots where the NBA players will take over. And there needs to be some accountability within that group that looks at a Kayser Kajami Keane, a Phil Scrub, a Aaron Dornenkamp in the eye and says, a Dwight Powell, a Corey Joseph, and says, we can't do this because blank. And there are acceptable answers to that. If you don't have a contract and you're waiting for your next multi-million dollar contract, I understand it. If I was going to say if you're a Kardashian, but I'm not going to walk that road. If you don't have the excuse, and listen, I get what they're asking. They're asking a lot of athletes, especially in a condensed offseason this year. But I think what needs to happen is we need to come together as a country that supports basketball, put these athletes in the position to succeed so there are no longer excuses. And let me be honest, there have been legit excuses in the past of Canada basketball not taking care of its athletes and not doing the right thing. I think now those excuses are the past, and we need to celebrate the ones that show up so that the ones that don't understand what's at stake.
I'm with you on that, Tim. Now, when talking about celebrating what Denis Shapovalov did today, when I watched that match this morning, I thought if this was the Chapeau of old, there were a couple of times where things didn't go his way and we could have seen the shoulders drop and mentally his game would have dropped and he probably would have given in, and we'd be talking about a loss again this morning. There's something that I've seen in him at this tournament. I saw it against Bautista Agut in the quarterfinals. I saw it again today. Do you think he's finally taken that next step in terms of self-belief and the mental toughness that you need?
I do, and I think that's something that, you know, I don't think it's any secret that Felix and Chapeau are good friends. And I don't think it's any secret that Chapeau kind of rolled through. I mean, listen, the straight sets victory to get here, I don't know that I saw a lot of that. There are points, but I don't know that I saw his, like the resiliency tested as much as it was today. And those are huge steps for tennis players at this level, especially in Grand Slams when you're playing five sets. And to get through those, I was remarkably impressed with Felix, because there are a couple of times against Zverev, who is better than basically anyone Shapovalov has faced outside of what used to be Andy Murray. And I think both of them have shown flashes here of what you need to be to get to that next level. And that's what's mostly, I'm with you. Like, I've seen a little bit of it. I think I saw a little bit more of it in Felix against Zverev, and we'll see what he does today, already down a set. But at age 20 and 22, to start seeing visions of that, I think that's what tennis fans, that's what Canadian sports fans, because we all know Canada will support its own once they see some success. And I think sports fans in Canada should be excited about these two and Bianca when she's healthy, because that's the kind of intestinal fortitude, to steal a line from Gorilla Monsoon. And, as I said it, I realized I was teeping a WWE Gorilla Monsoon line that I should probably credit. But that's the kind of guts that you love watching in sports. And you're right, Karen. I saw that in Chapo, and I saw it without a doubt. Felix drop shot at 30-15 in the match-clinching game. I was just like, wow, like this, that's guts. And I don't know that I've seen that from either of those two as much as I've seen it from, say, Bianca.
It's funny how my fandom has changed towards the Canadian, because I've always cheered for Felix and Shapovalov. But when, say, Roger Federer, who I'm a huge fan of, played Milos, I actually cheered for Roger, especially in Grand Slams, because I wanted him to win more Grand Slams. But Scott theoretically asked me, if Felix was to play Federer, and again, that it would have to happen in the semifinals, they both still have to win. He's like, who would you want to win? I'm like, well, Felix. Like, it's just, I want that Canadian tennis to continue, and I want them to take that next step.
And they're likable. They're both. And listen, Shapovalov plays a game. Like, even if you aren't a huge tennis fan, like, you can. He makes all of the shots. There's no like, Listen, I love Milos. He at times with the huge serve, like many in tennis, can be a little bit tedious to watch. Shapovalov hits shot. Felix hits shot. Like, they are a new generation of tennis player that I enjoy. And I think that's part of why a lot of people can get behind them the same way that you're getting behind them, Karen, is that it's not just serve and volley or serve and play 7-6, 7-6, and then wait for the tiebreakers. It's a completely different game. And I think that's part of the lure here, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that was always the knock on Sampras. And look, Milos doesn't have anywhere near the hardware. I'm not comparing them on that level. But Sampras, despite being a great champion, wasn't particularly attractive to watch, despite how clinical he was. It's why I personally was always attracted to Agassi in those days. And that's a part of the reason a lot of people gravitate to Chapo, because of that same flair.
Yeah, and why I watched a lot more women's tennis than I did men's tennis. Because
it frankly got
boring. And there were women that were still hitting shots. And even Serena, the greatest of all time, hit shots. Like, she had a serve. Of course she had a serve. But she hit shots. And I felt like we lost that for a little while in men's tennis. And I really feel like these two guys represent a new generation that I'm more than willing to watch. Because I'll be honest, I'm not a fan like Karen. Like, I move in and out of it based on who I like and what draws me in and storylines. And these two have definitely drawn me in. And Felix down one game to none, although everyone's on serve in the second set.
Appreciate the update there. Tim McAuliffe joining us for another midweek McAuliffe edition here on Rintoul and Sermon. While we're talking intestinal fortitude, we might as well just continue to use it throughout the course of this segment. Montreal showed some the other night. This isn't the Toronto Maple Leafs, and that's not just me taking a pot shot. We're talking about the defending Stanley Cup champs and one of the best teams we've seen assembled in the salary cap era. Some might argue the best. Do you see enough to think maybe, just maybe, they can do something tonight to bring this series back to Montreal?
Let me just say this. We play these games one at a time, and we look at numbers like 3-0 and say there's not a chance in hell against this team that hasn't lost back-to-back games in the playoffs since 2019. I get that. My brain tells me that repeatedly. But I also know that if you happen to win this game by chance in Tampa tonight, we've got a whole new series. And I know all it takes is the talent of Tampa to come shining through for one game, and this jam is done. I thought the same against the Leafs, It was a 3-1 hole. It was not as good a team. But Montreal just keeps believing, and they've faced more adversity this season than one team can face. Like, I mean, when you put the COVID and the coaches and all the things that have stacked up against them, the two best defensemen playing with one hand, they have repeatedly shown that if you give them a chance, they will walk through that door. And every fiber of my brain tells me, Scott and Karen, that this thing is done. But if they win tonight, can you imagine the scene Friday night in Montreal? Because, listen, Tampa's not, they are defending Stanley Cup champs. They are the most talented team, but they're also not that far removed from some bitter, bitter defeat that had a lot of people questioning their intestinal fortitude. So there is absolutely no chance you will have me closing the book on the Montreal Canadiens, even though every fiber of my brain tells me that this should be done.
And they need to win tonight to make this a series and to make us actually start to go down the hypothetical highway of, okay, where would this comeback rank among some of the great ones in championship history? We limited the field to this century, and it's got to be either a championship game or series. I don't want to hear American League championship with the Red Sox here, Tim. I'm talking about you got to be.
Them.
Yes, I am.
You're
you got to win. Them, you got to win the ultimate prize in your comeback to qualify for today's conversation. What is the standard for you this century in terms of ultimate comebacks?
Champs League is crazy. I don't think I've ever, I just don't know that enough Canadian fans understand what Liverpool did. Like, it was like jaw-droppingly crazy. I think though, Falcons 28, like you could just say the score and people know what you're talking about. But even that, I don't think is on this level where you're talking 3-0 down modern day. Like, the only time it happened in a cup final at the highest level was 1942 during a war. Like, this would be the greatest comeback that I have ever seen if Montreal was able to pull it off. And I say that knowing full well what, and think of, like, this would be the opposite. This would be like Tom Brady having the 28-3 lead, because Montreal is not even supposed to be there. And the defending cup champs, $18 million over the cap, all of those things like this. I honestly think, like, I'm going through in my head what the answer to your question would be, and if the Habs pull this off, this would be the greatest comeback of all time.
I'm with you on that one, Tim. I wanted to ask you one thing before we let you go here, because we can't let you go without talking about the CFL and the fact that partnership talks came to an end with the XFL today. Your initial thoughts when you heard this, did you think it was ever going to go anywhere, or are you not surprised that this is where we're at?
No, I thought this might go somewhere. I'm going to be honest with you. I thought that we were on the verge of losing the CFL. And I'm glad that we're not losing the CFL, and I'm glad we're not losing three-down football, but I also think that this is a very important time for fans in Vancouver, fans in Calgary, fans in Toronto and Montreal to figure out whether or not they really want this. I think this should be a reexamination of time, or of sorts. And I don't know that we're there yet. I think the conversation that this brought up was very important, and I don't think it's dead. I think the announcement today from the CFL was to say, you better not think this is dead. And Randy Ambrosio just didn't have the guts to say it. This to me is, what do we want as Canadians? Do we want this league? Do we want to support this league? In Vancouver, you know it well. Louis Pisaglia hit a field goal with Canadian flags draped all over BC Place, and it felt like this is what we really want. And you can blame it on David Braley. You can blame it on ownership in other markets. You can blame it on the CFL and Randy Ambrosio if you want. But what it comes down to is whether or not Canadians want a distinct league of their own, or we're just going to cheer for whatever our team is in the NFL. And I've always thought that if you love football, you can love any type of football. If you support and make the trip down to Pullman or wherever you head to watch your college football, why the hell can't you do that in Canada? Why the hell do we not have that in Canada? Why don't we build the atmosphere in Canada that we moan for in the States? Oh yeah, but you got tailgate and you got this and the band and you got, so why can't we build that in Canada ourselves? It could be on one tenth the scale. If you love football, you have to determine whether or not you want this, because it will not last unless you want this. And that's the bottom line. And I can't believe I'm making such convincing statements on each, but I'm telling you, Montreal is the greatest comeback of all time if they do it, and the CFL will die if people don't get out and support it. And people need to decide what they want to do with the CFL, because that's what's at stake here.
And your point about Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal is a very good one, and there's a spin-off conversation we can have another day about if those markets don't work, are there other pockets that could make it work in this country? Like, those are far-reaching discussions, but your grander point is a very good one, Tim, and it's an interesting year because this is an opportunity where people are looking for something to do in places like Vancouver, Toronto, and Montreal. Whether you're a football fan or not, this needs to be almost marketed as, this is something for you to do. You can get together, and you can sit outside and, you know, sort outside when you're talking about a BC place and the roof open. But you can sit there with a few of your fellow community members, your family, you can have a beer and just do something. And maybe, maybe you end up liking the product along the way.
Yeah, we've been hearing support local throughout the pandemic, and yet we don't apply that to sports, and that to me is baffling.
Buddy, thank you very much for your time. Once again, congratulations on the nomination once again. Let's go, Felix.
Let's go, Felix. And I've always said the show is award eligible. I didn't think we would actually get there.
Congrats, buddy.
Take care, guys.
Congrats, Tim.
That is Tim McAuliffe. Another thought-provoking conversation with him. And we find ourselves at this juncture every time we have a convo with Tim that we need a few more minutes, and it spurs on further conversations. Well, I do think there's a bigger one to be had with the Canadian Football League. I'm interested to see how it goes in the major markets. Look, we know where the people are going to turn out for sure in this country. Mm-hmm. The biggest markets are the ones that face the biggest challenges. Can you get it to work? I don't know. I want to say yes, and it seems like such an easy thing to me. It seems like such an easy thing to you, because we're consumers of the product already. And when you're already there, it should be easy to get. What percentage of the population are we actually talking about? A very, very small one in the major markets in which I'm speaking of. And yet,
20,000 people. Yeah,
that would be great. And yet that feels like a stretch in some of the places right now. And look, we can have a bigger conversation about what capacity is going to be and what you should limit it to this year. Just get a few people out to get together. We've all been waiting for that for about a year and a half. Can you utilize that unique opportunity right now to turn a few new people onto the game?
Yeah, you and I are both looking forward to it, Scott. I know one of the first things I want to do August, when I'm allowed to go watch a football game, when that's been announced, tickets are on sale, I'll be first in line, because like you said, it's not just about watching football, and for me it is, but for a lot of people is, I want to get back to a sense of normalcy, I want to get back into a stadium, I want to watch some beers in the kind of sun at BC Place, like I just want to get out and do something again with my friends and family, and I think that just points to it, and you have pointed all along about the fact that this is a great marketing tool. It's just like the CFL, want to do something? Well, we're back.
Exactly. And I know that sounds kind of funny, and it's not the catchiest phrasing, and you'd need to clean it up a little more from that. But there is a unique opportunity here. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon. It has been a lengthy hour. We pushed the envelope on this one. We'll continue to when we come back. We got a lot of great responses from you coming in. And Elliot Friedman broke it down. You'll hear it next on Rintoul and Sermon.
You're listening to Rintoul and Sermon.
This is a really good one. I didn't think about this one that came in the text message inbox. We will get to it, Karen. It's not one any of us want to remember on this side of the border, but it's a great one, and we would look at it far differently if the jerseys were reversed. It's Rintoul, it's Sermon. We've been asking about the greatest comeback in championship games or series this century. And I'm talking league championship, not American League. Don't try to get out on a technicality. Don't try to put the Red Sox in there. We're talking you need to get the ultimate prize at the event in your league for your season by winning, by coming back. That's what has to qualify you.
I mean, I get people saying the Yankees and the Red Sox. It's the Yankees. It's the Red Sox. And you're down 0-3, and the way that the Red Sox had to come back and the fact that it led them to ending their drought because they won the World Series title. It was impressive. You want to talk about some of the biggest comebacks ever in sporting history? Yeah, that one's definitely up there in the conversation. But this one's we're just taking a little bit different, because if the Maple Leafs come back, they're going to win the title, so we want to relate it to if you've won the title. 28-3, they won the Super Bowl. 2-0, and Canada ends up beating Team USA in the women's 2014 gold medal game. Ends up in the title. Like, that's where we want to go with this. Keep the stakes a little higher.
Exactly, and we're keeping it to this century. There are a lot of great comebacks. We've seen people reference the 1999 Champions League final. Just missed the cut, just like the Houston Oilers not being able to get the job done, and the Buffalo Bills coming back in the greatest playoff comeback in NFL history, despite what the Patriots did. 35-3 at the half, or I guess early in the third quarter. Houston not being able to get the job done. The Buffalo Bills coming. That doesn't qualify because it's not in this century, and it also wasn't a championship game. It's a tough question. You and I will make a case a little bit later on. I don't know which one you're going to choose. I think there are some very good cases to be made. We will wait and see. Here's what I want to know from you, though. This might be the toughest sports question you are asked all day, because I know where your loyalties lie. And this is a really big day in England for a bunch of different reasons. Chapo made good. He's into the semifinal. Felix is playing right now. By the way, Roger Federer is down 2-0. He is getting smacked in the third set. He might be straight sets and out and might not advance. So if Felix can get the job done, I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's a fait accompli, but the road opens up. It's not Roger Federer that might be waiting in the semifinal, but there's a lot of things that have to happen for that to occur. England's playing Denmark today at Wembley. An opportunity to go to the Euro Championship. Sunday at Wembley. So, Karen, if I give you the ability today to put one person or one team in a final on Sunday, you can either put one of the Canadian tennis players in the Wimbledon final right now. I'm giving you a pass through the semi. Or you can put England in the Euro Championship. Which do you choose, Karen?
I thought you were going to add or the Habs in the Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Final. Can I plead the fifth on this one right now? It's too hard for me to choose. oh, my goodness. I got to go with England. This opportunity comes only once every, well, 4 years for the Euro Cup, 2 years for a championship in terms of the World Cup and the Euro Cup. As much as I'd like to see one of the Canadians in the final, you're only saying one, right? You're not saying both. So it's not like the possibility for them to be guaranteed a Canadian championship.
Okay, what if I up the stakes to that? What if I up the stakes to Chapo versus Felix in the Wimbledon final or England in the European Championship, in the Euro Cup? What do you choose?
Oh, did I just say the Maple Leafs? I mean the Habs in the Stanley Cup final. Oh, my gosh. This is one of the hardest questions you've ever asked me.
I know.
And you've asked me some very difficult ones. I'm going to have to go with England again. I'm going to have to do it, Scott. I'm sorry. I know that I'm putting my Canadiana behind me on this one, and I'm not choosing that. I just have to go with England.
You know I'm disappointed because I do not share your passion for the English football side. I understand why you're doing it, and with the road lining up and England being able to play at home against Italy, something we haven't mentioned yet, the Italians, the team that I back, half the job's complete for our bet to materialize. We don't have the stakes as of yet, but the Italians got through. Wild game against the Spanish. We will talk about that with Craig Forrest in the third hour of the program. You are not going to put two Canadians in the Wimbledon final and guarantee Canada its first Grand Slam title in men's singles history of tennis?
Oh, I'm going to have a lot of people. I'm going to have a lot of people hating me right now, especially if you're Canadian and you're Canadian tennis fan. One of my good friends, Kurt, I apologize for this. No, I got to take England, Scott. It just doesn't happen very often. The fact that this team is primed right now to, well, hopefully beat Denmark, but they just look like they're one of the better sides that England's had in years. It's kind of just all setting up for them. And the fact for them to possibly go up against the Azzurri and win at Wembley, win at home, and all the demons of years past are gone. I think I got to go with England in this one.
All right. I'm disappointed, but I understand. And good for you for making a very tough decision. I gave you one of the ultimate tough decisions because I know where your fandom lies. We are asking you to make some tough decisions as well. Tough decisions when it comes to greatest championship comeback that you've seen. Someone texted this in, unsigned texter, and it's a really good one. And he or she did not have the year. Said you'll have to fill in the year. It's 2011. World Junior gold medal game. Canada was up 3-0 in the third period to Russia. That Russian comeback was one for the ages. It was. And if the script is flipped and it's Canada coming back, we're talking about that. But nobody in this country really wants to have that memory. But it's a really good submission. 2011 World Junior final. Canada up 3-0 heading into the third, and the Russians came back to win that game and take the gold medal 5-3.
You're going to have to remind me on that one. My mind's going to blank because there's so many Canada versus Russia games, Scott. Where was that one of the ones in Red Deer? Where was that one?
I believe that was in Buffalo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm drawing a blank.
Buffalo,
so I can't talk about that game at all because it's just like I just don't have memory of that one. It's crazy, though, how you think it's like if it's Canada the other way again, like you said, it's one of the more epic comebacks. And Canada's had some pretty epic comebacks against Russia in the World Juniors. We can all point to, you know, Jordan Eberle. We all know what happened in that series. But yes, Canada, Russia. I'm drawing a blank on it, Scott.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I bet you there are a lot of other Canadian hockey fans who are drawing a blank on that one as well. And Canada looked so good in that tournament. Ultimately, could not get the job done. Braden Shen, most valuable player in that tournament. Tough to accept at that point in time. Smile for the camera. You're the most valuable player. Nope, we didn't get the gold medal. That kind of sucked.
Is that as bad as this past juniors when the captains, so it was Bowen Byram, has to hand out the medals and poor Bowen Byram is handing out the silver medals to the losing Canadian team who was expected to go in and just romp the U.S. with that roster that they had put out there?
Do you think they were going to romp the U.S.?
Well, just the expectations going in. Like, they had run through their competition. The U.S. started slow, and I understand they came on. But we were talking about them
as
in
one of the
relation
greatest
to, like, the 2005 team, which is the greatest junior team of all time and with that roster. Like, they were talked about in that conversation. So, yeah, I thought they were going to maybe not route the U.S., but, yeah, I absolutely thought the gold medal was in the bag.
I am with you that I expected Canada to win. Because of everything you just mentioned, I didn't think it was going to be a route. That U.S. team was simply too talented, ultimately proving too talented for Canada in that tournament. I think it's worse to do the most valuable player thing, and only because of this. Yeah, that's hard for Bowen Byram, but you're also at least seeing your teammates one by one, and while you're all disappointed, you're kind of sharing in that. But to be singled out at that point when you've just had
a 3-0
lead, when you've had a 3-0 lead get away, and you get up there and you accept your most valuable, like, you're in the spotlight by yourself. At least with Bowen Byram, his teammates are participating in that with him.
That's like the J.S. Chagar, right? Like, he won the Conn Smythe the year that Anaheim lost the Stanley Cup. Because usually it always goes to the winning team. But that year, and he's just... I have this vision, and again, this is going back to, what, 2004 or something like that? Like, a really long time ago. And I have a vision of him just being like, yeah, thanks. And walking off the... Okay, bye. I don't really care about this right now.
Longtime fans will remember Ron Hextall doing the same thing with the Flyers in the 80s when the Oilers got her done in Game 7. Let's get to what they're saying. Habs looking to do a little more staving tonight, hoping to keep that dream alive. We will talk more about that. Dave Randorf, play-by-play voice of the Tampa Bay Lightning at the bottom of the hour. Certainly in the final hour of the program, we'll tee you up more for that as well. Stu Cowan of the Montreal Gazette will join us in the final hour of the program today, get different views on what goes down tonight. As soon as this series is over, it's officially the offseason, and there's a bunch of things that are going to happen. Buyout window will be triggered 48 hours afterward, and certainly that's an interesting situation in places like Vancouver where Jim Benning is on record as saying we're going to use buyouts, and he said plural in that situation. The Nate Schmidt situation has become interesting in Vancouver as well. Does he want out? Doesn't he want out? Elliot Friedman was on the air yesterday and explained it this way on Sportsnet 650.
So this is what I would say, Dan. This is all the information on this I can give you. At the end of the season, I heard that there were going to be at least two Canucks who were going to be asking to move. And, you know, one was JT Miller and the other was Nate Schmidt. As you guys know now, I reached out to JT Miller and he flat out denied that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he said that's not true. So I crossed one off the list. And then I was hearing that Schmidt was going to ask to go too. And I was, as a matter of fact, I was actually getting pretty close to reporting it. It was not long after the Canucks season ended. But then somebody brought a fact to me that was very difficult for me to counter. And that was that Schmidt had not had his year-end meeting with the Canucks. I guess his was later. So at the time I was looking into it, I was told that he actually, even though there was a rumor that it was going to happen and likely going to happen, it hadn't happened yet. So, you know, you can't, in that moment, you know, there was deniability there. There was definitely a situation where I would have been premature in reporting that. And then, you know, it came out later that I guess it was Rick who reported it, that that there was something going on there. And I think the way you guys framed it is true. I think there was a recognition there that Schmidt would like to go. And I think that the team is in a spot where, you know, they understand that it's not a perfect match for them maybe either. And so I think there's an understanding between the two sides that they will try to work together to find a deal. And I think that's kind of where we are right now. I don't know that there's actually a formal trade request there. I don't think that Schmidt necessarily had to come to them and say, I want out or anything like that. But I think everybody kind of knows where everybody stands, that maybe Schmidt would like to go somewhere else. And maybe the team recognizes the marriage isn't, you know, necessarily going to work out for both sides the way everybody hoped.
Nate Schmidt is in play. That's what Elliot Friedman is saying. And there's been some debate about whether that's true or not. Forget about whether this is a formal trade request. Doesn't really matter. He's in play. Doesn't mean that a deal happens necessarily, but Nate Schmidt is in play in Vancouver. Can they consummate a deal that would work for both sides? I have no idea. Jim Benning talked about being aggressive this offseason. Nate Schmidt will be seen as a commodity on the market. What Vancouver needs in a return, how they look to fill their defensive needs if they do lose a defenseman or decide to trade one away in this fashion, a lot of questions still to be answered.
So when I think about this, I think about Nate Schmidt, and I remember the press conference or Zoom, what media availability he had when he was first traded. He was really excited because he was really excited about the team that he saw in the bubble. And for whatever reason this season, it didn't work out, whether it was a fit on and off the ice, but definitely on the ice. It was a weird fit for Nate Schmidt, weird season for him. And we heard right after the end of the season, you know, like Schmidt and Elliot referenced it, like he didn't do his year-end interviews. He didn't speak to the media and do a year-end media interview. Like there was something a little off here about the whole situation. The one good thing that Jim Benning has he's got the trade chip in Nate Schmidt, but because it's not a formal offer, he doesn't have to sell low on him, right? Like, you have to get what you need in return if you're going to trade a player of Nate Schmidt's caliber. Like, I would suggest to you that they would need more than the third-round pick that they traded for Vegas because Vegas just needed him off the books. Like, you would have to get something back because you're already searching for a top four defenseman, and now you let him go or trade him, and now you need two top four defensemen.
And you're talking about a player who has term on his contract as well. Nate Schmidt has 4 years left on his deal that pays him a shade under $6 million per season. So there is a commitment that the other team is making. Sometimes these deals can be made in conjunction with others. We often talk about that. Like, hey, if Vegas is going to try to get Jack Eichel, it's probably going to involve two or three other teams, not just Buffalo and Vegas. Can you get creative? Can you find a way to do things a little bit differently if you don't have the right assets? if Vancouver were to move on from Nate Schmidt, does it have to be the traditional hockey deal? I know that's the most obvious road to go down. Can you get the assets you can use in another deal? Bottom line is what you mentioned. Absolutely true. This is a team that already needs bolstering on the back end, and if it moves on from Nate Schmidt, there's got to be something else coming in to fill up a bunch of holes to use that asset, that asset room well on your back end if that salary comes off your books.
Mm-hmm. And he does have a modified no-move clause, so there is a little bit of control that Nate Schmidt would have. It's, you just have to think, like, could you not sell him, though, on look? Like, last year was just such a weird year, and hey, maybe he, there's something he doesn't get along with Travis Green. I'm not reporting that, I'm just saying, like, maybe hypothetically that's a thing, but it was... You're coming off of a bubble. You're going into a situation in COVID where you can't hang out with your new teammates. You can't go out for beers with them. You can't go out for dinner. You can't do anything else. Like, maybe you sell them on the look. Like, I know last year really sucked coming to a new team, but like, this year's a brand new year. It's going to be basically back to normal. Just stay in one more year. Let's see what we can go from there.
We've seen a lot of players look like they were on their way out of respective markets and stay, and then things change, as you just alluded to. And Nate Schmidt's mind could change if he remains with the Vancouver Canucks. Mike Fiuta, former assistant GM of the Los Angeles Kings, was on the air this morning. And while we're talking trades, he shared some insight to when the Kings made that bold move, certainly helped them out, got a couple of Stanley Cups out of it. Jeff Carter, how did that deal come together when they got him to go to Los Angeles?
Columbus was that I had coached Jeff in the under-17s, and he obviously competed against him when he was in the Ontario Hockey League. And I just happened to be coming out from our practice facility, and Jeff was coming off, and I watched a bit of the practice, and I'd never seen the one thing about Jeff Carter, you know, when you get a, when he's in the right zone, is he's the first one at the rink. He's got a routine. He's got a big smile. He's the consummate pro. And he looked like he'd been run over by a truck. Like there was not an ounce of happiness in the practice. And he walked off, and he just walked by me, kind of gave me a little glove pump, and he's like, "Phew, get me out of here," which I have to be careful of because that's not an intentional conversation, but that was it. He just kept walking. And I went upstairs, and Ron Hextall had Carts in Philly, and it wasn't a great experience because Carts was, that's when they had moved on from Mike Richards and Jeff Carter at the time, late in there. And they were young. I mean, they were young, and I'm having success and having some fun, but he had matured. I mean, I just went upstairs and I just presented it to Dean that, I mean, I know he wants to be here. I mean, I know that this guy has plenty left in the tank as far as his fitness level. And I think this is one that if you bring him into an environment, like, I mean, you know, his wife's going to love it in Los Angeles. His life's going to be happy away from the rink. And we went ahead and made the move. I mean, Hex was a little bit against it at the time. And then he bought into it, and we made the move, and the rest is history.
Yeah, it all worked out pretty well. Not quite Earl Thomas going to the Cowboys locker room and yelling, "Come get me," but kind of along those lines. Hey, it's not a formal trade request, but a player who's unhappy makes that known behind the scenes in this case. Mike Fiuta giving us the inside story there and then saying, "I didn't even know this was really a possibility. Maybe we can culminate a deal." Obviously, this one worked out.
Yeah, a little fist pump, Scott, and that's all it really needed for Fiuta to know that, yeah, Jeff Carter still has more left. It was one of the deals. I always think of Jeff Carter as an LA King. Like, I always forget the fact that he started in Columbus that was where he was, and then they went to LA. But you always forget before because you think of Jeff Carter and all of the years that they won the Stanley Cup championships with LA. It's ended up being a pretty good deal. It just shows that when your assistant GM comes into someone and say, "Look, I have a good feeling about this guy. You should maybe take a flyer on him." Ron Hextall goes, "No, I don't know. Maybe not so much," but it worked out for them in the end.
Well, and this is where consensus is built. And that's what you need in an organization. Hey, here's why we should do something. Somebody else says, "I'm not so sure. Here are my reasons why I don't think it should happen." And once you walk out of that room, everybody's hashed it out and you're on the same page. Okay, maybe I didn't get what I want. I had my voice heard. Everything's been considered. Obviously, it worked out for the best in the case of Jeff Carter and the LA Kings.
So, Scott, 1 week ago, Wednesday, was our last workday of the week, right? And there hadn't been any rumors at this point when we got off the air at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. But then the tweets start coming out. I'm looking at Twitter. I'm thinking, Duncan Keith. Why is Duncan Keith trending on Twitter? Because that was the situation where it was getting out there that Duncan Keith has maybe requested that he wants to go to the Pacific Northwest or that he wants to go to a Canadian Western team. Then the reports come out, you know, that Vancouver's not interested in him, doesn't really think Seattle. Then that's down to Calgary and Edmonton. And then we get finalized to Edmonton. And it was really quiet on the situation until, was it Monday after the game, the Stanley Cup game, when Elliot Friedman spoke a little bit more on the situation. And now we're getting a little bit more information, like Duncan Keith and Edmonton. It's kind of come to a stalemate, and it could come to a head pretty soon.
Do we want to do this or not? Can we make this work or not? Christopher Stieg played with Duncan Keith in Chicago, knows the player well. Here's what he said the Oilers would be getting.
Edmonton makes a lot of sense from the standpoint that they just don't really have those intangibles in their room. They really need them more than anyone else, and you could see it in every time they go to the playoffs. They falter. They just need a guy that can stabilize the room. But I don't think you just need a cheerleader. And I still actually don't think that's what Duncan is. He's not just going to cheer on the sidelines and try to rally him in the room. He's going to be in there. He's going to be playing good hockey. I saw him play last year quite often, and he's still got a lot left to live. His foot speed's still really good. He still thinks the game at a high level. His points were down because he's not on the power play as much. But at the end of the day, he can still skate, he can still think the game, and he's still very valuable. Now, if he wasn't valuable on the ice and he was just in there rooting the guys on, I wouldn't think it would make any sense, especially for the cap hit. But right now, where he's at and how good a condition this guy stays in, he's one of the biggest freak athletes I've ever seen in my life. And I think this would be a great play for the Oilers, especially if they could also upgrade with another player somewhere in free agency that could help them as well in the back end shore it up.
Might he be the next big name on the move? We will wait and see. There's a bunch of them out there right now. I don't put Nate Schmidt in the same category of name. And we can talk about game right now where Duncan Keith is at, Nate Schmidt. But Seth Jones is out there. Duncan Keith might be coming at the end of his career to a new team. Maybe Nate Schmidt's on the market. Boy, I'm looking forward to some player movement here, aren't you?
Don't forget the UFA that is Dougie Hamilton, Scott.
There's him. Yeah, he's not bad. And that's a guy that maybe Chicago takes a run at if they move on from Duncan Keith and his salary and they move a few other things around financially. We're going to talk about a team that found the most creative ways to move things around financially, and they are one win away from winning the Stanley Cup, much to the chagrin of many Montreal Canadiens fans or fans who just won a great series. Dave Randorf is the play-by-play voice, of those Bolts. We'll give you an update on what's going on with Felix over at Wimbledon as well. It's next on Rintoul and Sermon.
Now back to Rintoul and Sermon.
James the Liquor Rep, you are correct, sir. I hadn't thought of that comeback. Not at all. In fact, I don't recall it, but I will share that story a little bit later on because you took the time to text it in. We're asking about some of the great comebacks in championship history. And yeah, it's got to be for the ultimate prize. And we're saying this century, so we don't go too far back. We had somebody text in earlier, Karen, saying, well, it's got to be the Leafs. They came from 3-0 down back in 1942. None of us remember that. We're limiting the field here a little bit.
Yeah, my memory of the 1942 Stanley Cup Finals is a little limited since I was born 40 years later after that fact. I'm getting a lot of praise and a lot of hatred in the inbox, Scott, for my take of taking England over a potential dual Canadian final at Wimbledon. This one comes in unsigned, but just because the English football lover picks over two Canadians in the Wimbledon final, she has just jinxed the Team England today against the Danes this afternoon. Slow clap, good evil laughter right there. This one also, Karen, unfortunately you should rescind your Canadian card, especially your Vancouver card. You're an Oilers fan, that's bad enough, but picking England over a Canadian winning at Wimbledon, never has it happened. Have to go with Canadian. English soccer has a history. Canadians can write their own. That's from Rob the Landscaper. One more says, hey, Karen, good job picking England. I've seen you have roots there, but that's a tough decision. I get it. I'm with you. I would have chose England as well.
Yeah, we had a couple other people saying it's soccer versus tennis, and to those who texted that in, they said soccer is far more important to them, and I'm sure they're cheering for Felix or Chapeau, but they care more about that sport than they do about tennis, so they're going that way. It was a difficult decision for you. I knew it would be a difficult decision for you. Good on you for making it and not taking the easy way out. I know that what you would prefer more than anything is to have all of those things happen.
Exactly. I would love to see my Friday and Sundays would be set going forward. Like for you, I mean, I know you're an Italian supporter and you have one team in the final anymore. Like, but is your European soccer pull good enough for you to say that you would want Italy to win the Euro Cup over whoever or to have the two Canadians in the final?
No, I will take the two Canadians in the final. Absolutely. In my lifetime,
you're a better
Karen,
Canadian.
Well, here's the other thing. We're talking about a team in England that has never won the Euro and has not had any type of major trophy in a sport that it holds so dear since 1966, whereas the Italians have won the Euro, and I've watched them win multiple World Cups in my lifetime. Yeah. So
you're spoiled.
Yeah,
you're spoiled.
Absolutely. I can very easily say I would much rather have Canadians in them. It makes the choice easier, but yeah, for me, it's having two Canadians in the final. It's guaranteeing Canada a men's singles victory at Wimbledon. If I could do that, I most certainly would. Could see a championship trophy handed out tonight. Dave Randorf is in a place where they would love that to happen. He is the play-by-play voice of the Tampa Bay Lightning, and he joins us now on what could be a championship Wednesday down in T-Bay. Dave, thanks for doing this. How are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Yeah, it's pretty exciting around here, that's for sure. It's, you know, if you think back to those days when you had those moments in Vancouver and or Calgary where you have listeners, there's high anticipation for what could happen tonight. It's a rare occasion to have the cup won on home ice these days, and it's a special sight, so it'll be pretty cool if it happens.
Well, especially after what happened last year, and it was in Edmonton and nobody could be there. We all know the unique nature of the situation and the fact that families in particular can't travel to Montreal. They couldn't get there for what would have been a Game 4 and sweep victory, which never actually occurred. Before we even get to that, everything okay? The hatches were battened down. Is everything okay in Tampa weather-wise?
I made it through my first hurricane, Scotty.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear it.
No, it was supposed to. It turned out to be not as bad as we were led to believe. Reports were that it was. I don't want to get into too much meteorological talk here, but apparently it was a scattered storm, so it kind of broke off into pieces and stayed just enough off the coast where we missed the worst of it, and it's gone. It's past us now. So, I mean, it was windy and rainy last night for sure, but everything's fine. I'm sitting out in my backyard right now. It's sunny and hot, and everything's back to normal.
Well, and I don't want to turn this into a meteorological report either, but I've often wondered this because I've never lived on the Eastern Seaboard and certainly never lived in Florida. Like, just the anxiety leading up to something like that, you know, in the western part of the North American continent, there's sort of the earthquake thing in the back of your mind that it could happen at some point in time, but it's not as ever present on a seasonal basis as hurricanes. Was it weird leading up to it for you?
Yeah, it was kind of weird. You know, obviously I knew moving down here that this is going to be a new reality. However, you know, Tampa's on the west, is on the Gulf side, Gulf of Mexico. So it's a little less common over here. For whatever reason. So, you know, usually travels up the east, as you say, the eastern seaboard, and we're on the western side. So, but we were in the eye of the storm for a while yesterday. Like, as of 5 o'clock yesterday, they were saying it was going to come right over top of us, but that never materialized, and all good, buddy. Now we can just talk about the hockey game.
Well, let's do that. Okay. The Lightning haven't lost two straight playoff games in the last two postseasons. You have to go back to that sweep by the Columbus Blue Jackets. It leads you to believe that things are going to go well tonight, David. What makes this team so resilient that this just doesn't happen?
Yeah, 2019 has a lot to do with it. When I got here, I was surprised that sweep by Columbus came up in conversation as much as it did. I was thinking, why are you still talking about that? But it's an important, hugely important part of the evolution of the team that you now watch today. It was a galvanizing point. They'd won 62 games that year, tied an NHL record. You know, I use the analogy, they were like a men's slow pitch team, swinging for the fences every night and cranking bombs on teams on a nightly basis. And then they got in the playoffs, had a 3-0 lead in game one and lost it, and everything fell apart from there. So they all looked themselves in the mirror. The core is still here. They've added pieces, important pieces, most notably Barclay Goodrow and Blake Coleman to a third line that is unprecedented. You know what? I'm going to switch off my pods here because I think the battery's died. One second here. Okay, you got me now?
We do. All good. No problem.
All right. So anyway, they added some core pieces and they looked themselves in the mirror as a group of players and as a coaching staff and decided they had to play a different way. And I think we've seen that. We saw that last year in the bubble, and I've certainly seen it all year this year, particularly in the playoffs. And that stat says it all, Karen. 6-0 this year following a loss, 13-0 following a loss going back to the beginning of last season. Vasilevsky in net for all of those. His numbers are crazy. And he has four consecutive shutouts in closeout games, going back to last year's Stanley Cup Finals. So that's a remarkable stat. And you know, one thing, nothing's certain. You know, as you say, all the stats point to them winning it tonight, but nothing's for sure. But one thing that I know that is for sure is that Andrei Vasilevsky will be prepared tonight. You will have to beat him three, maybe four times to win this game tonight, because he'll be locked in, and he'll be ready to go. And I've just seen it. And, you know, don't get me started on the Vezina trophy, but he's been amazing. He covers up so many mistakes that they tend to make occasionally here and there. But man, he is so locked in. It's interesting. Maybe they'll show it tonight on the Sportsnet coverage during the warm up, and you guys can attest to this. He is the last guy off the ice, certainly the last guy for the Lightning, and he kind of does this one final little mental prep thing where he lines up on an angle outside the blue line near the Lightning bench, looking at an angle, like a 45-degree angle back at the net, gets in a little kind of a, you know, he gets down on his knees and sprawls out a little bit and looks at the net and stays there all by himself for about 30 seconds. And you almost never see that. I mean, right, the starting goaltender is almost always the first guy off the ice, and he's the last guy off the ice. And it's just part of his mental preparation, which is a huge part of his success. And that is one thing for sure. He will be locked in, loaded tonight.
Well, I can tell you this. We had Rick Bowness on this program yesterday. Excellent conversation with the Stars head coach. And he said, look, I've been around a lot of really good goaltenders. Andrei Vasilevsky is the best I've ever seen, and he is the best goaltender in the world right now, not just this league. The praise he had for the Tampa Bay netminder, it was far-reaching, Dave.
Yeah, they had their way with Dallas over I believe he had two shutouts against Dallas this season. So Rick was asked about that a few times, and yeah, he is. You know, I see him on a nightly basis now, and the Lightning had a kind of an up and down last third of the regular season, and they were kind of, you know, they played a lot of hockey and they were in a bit of a lull, and they finished third in that division, and you know, he led the league in wins again. And he covered up, he stole games. They won games in spite of the way they played because of him. So anyway, I agree. He's the best goalie in the world. Don't at me. It's over. Don't even start with me on anybody else. That will be one factor you can take to the bank tonight.
We're speaking with Dave Randorf, Tampa Bay Lightning, a play-by-play announcer. Dave, I want to go back quickly to that line you just mentioned, that third line for the Tampa Bay Lightning with Barclay Goodrow, Blake Coleman, and Yanni Gourde, because Scott and I had a conversation last week, and we talked about the most underrated players on the Tampa Bay Lightning, and specifically it was led by a Blake Coleman conversation. But why is that team? Why is that line so dominant for this Lightning?
They just, you know, when you hear coaches say they play the right way and you kind of go, oh, here, that old line again. That's what they do. They play in straight lines. They don't take shifts off. They start every game. They start every period. You'll see that. They start every period for John Cooper because they set the tone. They get in your face right off the bat. Two guys on that line are undrafted, Yanni Gourde and Barclay Goodrow. Never drafted. And you know, they paid a heavy price to bring in Goodrow and Coleman. Both cost first-round draft picks, and people were critical of at the time, thinking, wow, that's a lot to pay for these guys, really? You know, what are you doing? And well, they don't win the Cup without them last year, and they're not in the position they are that they're in right now without them this year either. It's simple. There's nothing fancy about their game whatsoever. In fact, John Cooper used the analogy earlier a few weeks ago when asked about Barclay Goodrow. He said if he was a car, Barclay Goodrow would be a Jeep. You know, you can take him in the mud and he's reliable and he'll get you out of the ditch and it'll get into the ditch and all that stuff. So that's all they do. They just go up and down. They wear you out. They don't back down. They never stop. And Yanni Gourde is probably the engine of that line. He plays center and he is a buzzsaw. He can score. They can all score too. They don't score a ton. Yanni Gourde's got the most goals out of all of them, but Goodrow doesn't score as much, but he is invaluable to what he does in terms of, and they missed him. He didn't start the playoffs. He broke I believe it was a broken thumb. He got into a fight, I want to say, the second last game of the regular season against the Panthers. And I believe he missed 5 or 6 games, and they missed him big time. And so they're glad to have him back, because I would shudder to think where they'd be without the identity of that line. You look at all great Stanley Cup championship teams, including especially teams that would be in the kind of dynasty conversation where you're always there, you're in, you're out, and you win back to multiple cups, which the Lightning would put themselves in that category here with a win tonight. And they all have an identity line. And it speaks to the depth of this team and why not many teams can stack up to it, either the forward lines or their deep pairings.
We'll get back to that line in a second, and not just that line, because none of those – well, it might be that all of those players are somewhere else next season because of expansion, because of unrestricted free agency in the case of a couple of them. So we'll go back there in a second, but it's ironic that Tampa Bay is regarded as highly as it is, and yet we talk about underappreciated players. It just speaks to their depth and how many names you have to get past to get to some of those guys. Ryan McDonagh is one of them. He doesn't crack Tampa's top five as far as star power goes. John Cooper, he made sure to point out the other night how important Ryan McDonagh has been for the Lightning. What is the most underrated aspect of Ryan McDonagh's game?
You know, he's plus 17 in the playoffs. Plus 17. He doesn't have any goals. He's got 7 assists, including a beautiful assist in the last game 4 to set up a wide-open tap-in for Barclay Goodrow to get the Lightning on the board. He's never missed the playoffs in his career. Think about that. I believe this is the 11th year. He's been to multiple conference finals and now multiple Stanley Cup finals. That's not a coincidence. That's not just, you know, fluky circumstances. That should tell you everything you need to know and answer your question. He quietly goes about his business. If you ever listen to him speak, he's all business. He's very cerebral when talking about the game and talking about team and talking about the importance of chemistry and playing for one another and all that stuff. He's an intelligent guy, and he just quietly blocks shots, shuts things down in his own end, ends cycles. He can contribute a little bit offensively, but he doesn't need to. But, you know, the plus 17 should tell you. Like, nobody else is even close to his plus minus on the I think Chernak is in double digits, but that's it. And there's another guy who's underrated too, by the way, Eric Chernak. But, you know, Ryan McDonagh to me is the consummate pro. He played for years with the New York Rangers, was their captain, and, played on that big stage. And they also paid a big price to get him here as well. And so the most underrated aspect of his game is that you just don't notice him until you look at his numbers and you look at some key moments of the game. And remember that crazy goal he almost scored to tie it in game 6 against the Islanders? Look at the move he makes there. And it's only that great save by Ron Pulock in front of the net to keep it out. But just the ability to make that spin move on such short notice in such a tight space, I mean, that was going in. And only a miracle save by Pulock stopped it. So he is a treat to watch. He's a lunch pail guy, but he'll play major minutes again tonight. He'll make some key shot blocks tonight. You can always count on the guy. That's simply it. Again, who's there year in, year out, got, I don't know, I have the number in front of me, probably 150 games worth of playoff experience, and you can't buy that.
You read my mind when you said he hadn't scored a goal. That's the first thing I thought of, how he nearly scored against the New York Islanders. I know it's not the overarching storyline. Winning a second consecutive Stanley Cup is, and so it should be. But we all know what lies ahead. It's 2 weeks until the expansion draft. Tampa's salary cap situation, as you may know, Dave, has been talked about a fair amount. It's not the Beatles, but does it feel like the end of something? I know they're going to have people come up from the minors, and they're going to make some interesting moves. Does it feel like the end for this group, maybe in the same way it ended up being the end for that 2010 Blackhawks team that was dismantled shortly thereafter?
I don't know if you'll see as much, you know, of a dismantling as you saw for that team. I mean, they got rid of a whole bunch of guys off of that squad after they won. But there's no question about it that is a big part of the narrative with this group. They've talked about it themselves. And we've all noted, that those of us who are around the team and covering the team on a daily basis, that they sense and they all know that this is a special opportunity. This doesn't come around again all the time to be able to win not one but 2 cups with the same core. Obviously, they had unique circumstances that allowed them to keep everybody in place, that, you know, with Nikita Kucherov being hurt all regular season, and please let's not open that big can of worms. It's been talked about enough. We all know what people think, and I am aware of the optics of it. But, you know, here we are. The guy's leading the playoffs in scoring, and he's been a remarkable story. So that allows them to keep the core together, keep everybody together. And but there's no mistaking that the expansion draft and salary cap ramifications are quickly going to and free agency too. You know, you talk about Coleman, you talk about Goodrow. You know, those guys might get better offers somewhere else. So they all know in that room that this is it, boys. This is we're not going to be all in here together again next year. So let's make the most of this. And that is no secret around here. It's a big part of the story, and they can sense it, and they want to capitalize. And I'm quite certain, you know, I'm giving Montreal a ton of credit for being as resilient as they are. And they've been a great story themselves. And I know most of Canada is, you know, waving the Canadian flag and hoping that, you know, we can see a Stanley Cup champion north of the border again. But at the same time, I'm pretty sure you're going to see a very, very determined Lightning team to come out very hard to try to land 1, 2, 3 knockout blows early tonight.
Do it for the mayor. Is that what they're saying? No?
Jane Castor. I've met her a couple of times, and yeah, she's here to stir up a little something here going into game four. But yeah, that quickly got pushed to the side. Listen, you know what? In her defense, if I could just say, she said what every Lightning fan was thinking, but
yeah,
just wouldn't say out loud.
For sure.
You know, they didn't want to mess with it, but there's no doubt that now that they do have a game five and a cushion going into it, that everybody here is super. I'm excited to be in the building tonight. It's a cool moment, and there's no doubt that they would love to see it happen on home ice tonight.
Yeah, of course. Hey, it's a champagne problem, and when you're as good as the Lightning and you pick and choose a little bit, of course this is exactly what you would hope for. Dave, thank you very much for doing this. Glad you made it through your first hurricane. I hope you don't have to deal with any more anytime soon, all right?
Yeah, me too. But enjoy the game, and you know what? Check this. Appreciate this team. I know that it seems so far removed from Calgary and Vancouver and knows the border and everything else, but it's a pretty impressive group, and they're it's a good group to cover. It's just you don't see this every day, back-to-back Stanley Cup championships. So we'll see if it happens, but it's a pretty cool moment if it does.
Thank you very much for sharing your
Thanks,
time.
Dave.
Enjoy the game tonight.
All right, guys. Always a pleasure.
That is Dave Randorf, always generous with his time, and I certainly wasn't trying to make a pun on the fact that Tampa needed to go through the NHL version of the Hurricanes en route to getting to where they are, one game away from winning the Stanley Cup. You survived a tornado. You texted me while Dave was talking about the hurricane. You went through a tornado?
Legit tornado, yes. And I'm one sign away of hitting a window at a Pizza Hut from not being here today. Literally. So it was... I'll try and keep it as short as possible. We used to drive from Winnipeg down to Florida, and we take like a week and stop off of all these places. And tornado season in the Midwest is about start to middle of July. It goes a little longer now, but that's when it was. I'm in Columbia, Missouri. Don't know where it is. I don't either. Somewhere in Missouri. And we stayed there for the night, went to go to the Pizza Hut for dinner, sat at a window in a booth. My brother and I next to the window. You hear the sirens go off. That's when you try and take shelter. Tornado's coming. And all of a sudden, part of a sign from the restaurant beside us comes and hits the window. We're very lucky. It hit it flat. If it had hit it on any sort of an angle, it would have gone through and probably taken our heads off. So I survived a tornado. We were shoved in we hit the deck, obviously, first. And then we were shoved in a stand-up freezer in the back, a bunch of us, in the back of the Pizza Hut until the tornadoes tore through, went outside. All the windows of our car had been knocked in because of rocks that had been flying around. So we spent a couple of days at the Motel 6 in Columbia, Missouri as our car got fixed. But yeah, it was... crazy turn of events, that's for sure.
Man, that sounds harrowing. Glad you lived to tell about it. That sounds like a
Me
harrowing
too.
Tale. I did not know that. And I do not know what you are going to select as your greatest comeback this century in a championship series or game. But I will find out next. We have some great texts coming in as well. James Sharman is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. Yeah, we substituted. We made a switch to our starting lineup today. It's going to be James Sharman, not Craig Forrest. We'll tell you how Felix is doing. He is fighting, man. He is fighting over at the All England Club. And that's a very good thing after dropping the opening set. It's Rintoul and Sermon right after this.